This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll learn about a young mother's fight to keep her family off the streets of Hartford. It's the latest installment in our housing and homelessness series with WNPR contributor Susan Campbell. But first, Christina Newman Scott is almost a year into her job as director of culture for the state of Connecticut. It's a role that is suited and tailored to her. She's a visual artist who held a similar job in the city of Hartford. It's also a change of direction for the State Department of Economic and Community Development. Her predecessor in a different kind of job was Kip Bergstrom, who focused his energy on the tourism piece of the culture puzzle. Today, we're going to find out about the state of the arts in our state. And you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Christina Newman Scott, Director of Culture for Connecticut. Welcome back to the show. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
What does it mean to be Director of Culture?
You know, this is the million-dollar question. I seem to take on these wonderfully awkward titles. Before this, remember, I was the Mecca director.
Yes.
I'm still trying to figure that out.
And this was in the city of Hartford.
Yes, this is the city of Hartford.
I love acronyms in Hartford, but yes, it was similar to this, yeah.
So, you know, as Director of Culture, I oversee the Connecticut Office of the Arts, the State Historic Preservation Office, and our cultural initiatives, and that includes overseeing 4 of the state's museums as well. So, you know, it's all things culturally enriching.
when I said off the top there that your job is in some ways, there's a straight line from Kip Bergstrom's job, and we spent some time certainly talking with him on the show, to your job. It's not exactly the same position. How is it different? How can you describe that difference?
Yeah, so Kip was a deputy commissioner, and under Kip's leadership, there was arts, culture, tourism, and historic preservation. When Kip moved on, the commissioner, Catherine Smith, decided to focus a little bit more deeply on the cultural and creative sector and created the director of culture position that reports directly to her. So I get to join my colleagues, Deputy Commissioner Tim Sullivan and Deputy Commissioner Bart Colin, who is our new deputy commissioner, but I'm not a deputy commissioner. But the great thing is that I have direct access to the commissioner, kind of connecting that thread, right? What is the role arts play in economic development. So she really is committed to better understanding that.
And I think in a little bit we'll be talking a bit more about, you know, some of the obvious issues with the state budget, what it's going to mean for the arts and everything else, take some phone calls. But talk a bit about what you see as the role of the arts in economic and community development. It's a conversation I've had for years with Catherine Smith and other people, people who have arts institutions. There's always this tension, I think, now because some years ago, there was a sense that the arts could be a really important part of economic development.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a good thing. It can create jobs. It can create mm-hmm. vitality. But the more the arts moves into the category of an economic driver, the more, and this is my view,
right,
and maybe some others, that it loses some of the intrinsic nature of what the arts is supposed to be. That if you say arts is about economic development,
right,
then you're saying the arts isn't anything by itself without a job.
Right.
So talk about how you see that tension, if there is some, in your role and where that sits within the DECD.
Yeah, you know, it is a balancing act. And coming from a background as a practicing artist, you know, my background, I was a painter and installation artist and worked in film and TV. So, you know, I come to this position looking through several distinct kind of creative lenses, right? So as a practicing artist, as a curator, as an arts administrator, and I believe fundamentally that there are that intrinsic quality and value that's key. That's the most important. I mean, come on. Not all of these things are quantifiable. We can't put them on a chart. It's not like we just built X amount of homes for X amount of people. That being said, we do work in an environment that data is important, right? And so making sure that we're translating the impact that the art is making within our communities in a way that's connecting with our policy change makers, right? Because some of them will get it. And some need the data. And so for me and our department at the Connecticut Office of the Arts, we always try to reinforce both. Connecticut is, in the nonprofit arts, over $600 million industry. We employ within the nonprofit and for-profit over 35,000 people across the state. And when you include for-profit and nonprofit, we have over, let's see, around 11,000 creative industry and arts-related businesses. That's a big deal.
So, that's a lot of jobs. That's a lot of jobs.
Yeah. And, you know, when we look at the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis released data last year that essentially showed that the impact on the creative sector on the national GDP is around 4.3%, which is more than shipping, warehousing, transportation, construction, and tourism. That's important for people to understand.
And that's where the balance comes in, because yes, you have to make the case for the arts by using those numbers. But then let's just say those numbers change, or
right,
the economic conditions change, and then you start to look at, okay, what's important and why.
Right.
So make that case. When you talk to your colleagues, maybe people who don't come from an arts background,
right,
make the case for why the arts is a pure thing, something that people enjoy and enriches them, is something we need to invest in, even if you can't put a dollar sign next to it.
Okay, well, simply, every one of us, at least we try to, we think about taking vacation with our families, right? You think about, you know, where am I going to go that's special? I want to take a trip. And whether you're staycationing or going away, the first thing, I have never heard or had a conversation with anybody that came back from an enjoyable experience by themselves or with friends and family that have not said these things to me. We went to X place. The food was phenomenal. The architecture, the creativity, the music, the people, the energy. People don't come back and talk about, you know, the street. Well, they might say the streets are really clean. I mean, these things are obviously important.
Yes.
But that quality. So, you know, when people go away, it's those things that make these experiences special. And those things are fed by the creative sector. And I believe that those experiences shouldn't just be for the times that we're going away on a vacation to somewhere else. Those things should be how our everyday lives feel. And so I think about this idea about how do we make this tangible, right? This quality of life piece. How do we make that more tangible? I mean, as we sit in this room, every single thing that we're surrounded by is designed for us. That's part of it. There's nothing that we touch that isn't impacted by a creative person. Every single thing is designed. But for me, I just think about the basics. When you are had a hard day at work and you want to go somewhere to release, it might be a film, you might want to put on music, you might want to sit and read, all of those things reinforce the importance of creativity.
And because we have so many things now that we can choose, does that create in some ways another challenge for you as someone working in a field where bringing people together to experience the arts is very, very important, whether it's a museum, a symphony orchestra, a gallery? So many people are able to experience art now at home with their iPad. And frankly, it doesn't matter, Christine, if they're in Connecticut or if they're in Kingston, Jamaica, where you're from, or if they're in California. And so talk about that as well, about the challenge of trying to get people behind culture when there's so much culture at your fingertips.
I think it's kind of great that there's so much culture at your fingertips, but there's nothing that will ever replace that direct contact, right? And so NEA did a study that showed that over 54% of all Americans last year experienced at least one exhibition, performance, some kind of creative event. That's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I don't remember how many Mega Millions, but that's over 200 million easily. People might be watching films more from their iPhones, iPads, and various devices, but I can tell you, I mean, look at Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Look what just happened with Hamilton. People aren't staying away from that direct contact with artists. They're just not.
We're talking with Christina Newman Scott. She's Director of Culture for the State of Connecticut. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking about a project that we've mentioned on the program before. This is in my hometown of Winsted. It's gotten a big boost from the state and has some new milestones to celebrate. If you have questions about the state of the arts in Connecticut, 860-275-7266. You grew up in Kingston, Jamaica.
I did.
You're not from around here. Tell me about being a young visual artist growing up in Jamaica and how you made it here to Connecticut.
Boy, I was forced to tell this story on this TEDx talk that I did, and I thought I literally was going to pass out before I went on stage. I didn't, thank God. But so growing up in Jamaica, like growing up in many places, I grew up as a middle-class Jamaican young lady. And my parents, you know, wanted me to be a doctor, lawyer, or an accountant, right? Because my mother was an accountant, so that was kind of strange. So I picked that because I knew that I would probably mess that up less than I would being a, you know, no one wants me to be a doctor or a lawyer.
That's right.
So I didn't, thank God, I forced my way through art college in Jamaica. My parents came around, and I literally, when I graduated art college, just became super curious about how I could use these skills in the world that I existed in Jamaica, right? Like, so I wasn't going to go and get a job being whatever. I just refused to do that. And so whether it meant spraying Pepsi bottles with glycerin as a prop assistant or, you know, helping a gaffer or, you know, I also sold my art. It was a really interesting journey. And I think because I threw myself directly into the creative industry and then moving to Connecticut in 2005, it was a thing that set me apart from a lot of my peers that were the same age but were just leaving college with their masters, where I had years of work experience across, you know, various sectors within the creative industry. So I think really that kind of helped me truly understand even more so how to position the arts in communities. And that's why right now we're doing a statewide arts and cultural strategy, which is going to be wrapped up by the end of August. And that's really going to help the Office of the Arts chart a path for the next 5 years about how we're doing what we're doing and why we're doing and if we're supposed to be doing that. That's really what the community needs from us.
This idea of trying to figure out what the community needs is really interesting. And I think probably your story helps to get us a little closer to that than maybe people who grew up around here and have a very different perspective. I mean, something I've learned from talking to many, many people in the state about the arts and other things is every once in a while, and I know you've heard this, Connecticut can have a little bit of an inferiority complex. We feel stuck between Boston and New York. And when you came here as a visual artist who'd been working already, and you're thrown into this as an immigrant to this country, and you look around and you say, here's an opportunity. I mean, what perspective does that give you about the arts and culture scene, if you will, in Connecticut that maybe people who've just been struggling at it for years and years right here in Connecticut maybe didn't have?
I am so proud. I mean, I got to tell you, even when I go home to Jamaica, and Jamaica will always be home for me, but I am so proud to be from Connecticut. And this is awkward because I hate the cold, but I'm a Jamaican nutmegger. That's what I'm called. Like, that's what I am. And the historic and cultural richness of Connecticut is like none I've seen. Right. I know New York is, I mean, New York is on a planet by itself. OK, so we can't compare ourselves to New York. However, in Connecticut, we have places like the O'Neill. Right. They invented scripted readings. We have one of the oldest public art museums in the nation. We have, you know, some of the most phenomenal minds in our creative sector coming out of Connecticut. You can't throw a stone. You know, in Boston, you can throw like a pebble and it hits a dog park. Mm-hmm. There's like a dog park every five minutes. Yeah. You can't throw a pebble here and not hit some kind of fantastic historical or creative space or site, really. We're chock full of them. And it's, you know, it's surprising to me that we have that little, we're like, you know, maybe the emo kid in the corner. And but Connecticut's fantastic. And to me, arts is the product. The creative engine is the product that feeds tourism.
Yeah. One last thing before we take a break. In that TEDx talk, which we'll have links to on our website, wnpr.org/where we live, where Christina Newman Scott tells her personal story. There's a line that I loved, and it was after you came to Connecticut, and you were trying to figure out what your place was in the arts world, and just figuring out, you know, going to shows, meeting people, and you said, "My hustle is art."
Yeah.
What would you mean by that?
My hustle was art because that's the energy that I had inside, the knowledge that I had from learning and being in the world of creativity in Jamaica was the thing that was driving me. So anytime I felt like I had to like redirect, reset, it was all about what's going on in the creative world. You know, whether it's Trinity College with a reggae station, I just was so wide open about it, whether it's driving to New York and there was like, you know, Mattis Yahoo and I could interview him, I'm going to do that. So I was willing to hustle, but it was going to be hyper-focused on creativity.
And I will say, we're going to meet when we come back from our break someone who we've spoken with in the past who is one of the great art hustlers that I know, and I mean that in the absolute best way. Ellen Grzydyk is the artist and president of the American Mural Project. She's got a good update coming up. We're visiting with Christina Newman Scott, the director of culture for the state of Connecticut. We'll be right back after this break, Where We Live. The This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're visiting with Christina Newman Scott. She's the Director of Culture for the state of Connecticut. We're talking about the state of the arts in our state. I want to bring into the conversation Ellen Grizedick. She's our friend, artist and president of the American Mural Project. We've focused on the American Mural Project a couple times on our program over the years as they've tried to get this massive project underway in my hometown of Winsted, reclaiming an old mill building for this amazing art mural. Ellen, welcome back to the show, first of all.
Oh, it's great to be here, John.
First of all, but before we talk about some of the updates that you have on this, explain what the American Mural Project is for people who maybe haven't heard about this yet.
Oh, it's funny. Someone, one of our board members said, by the time you finish describing this, you'll be so sick of it. And after 16 years of waving my arms about it, it's going to be the world's largest collaborative mural. We say this because it's indoors, it's in a space that is equivalent to the Parthenon after we get the roof up. And the unique part of it, of course, is that we're working with kids across the country in all 50 states that are helping us contribute to this. It's a tribute to people who work in this country. So everything that's depicted has something to do with work and work ethic in the country, but it spans the full gamut. And it's been a good 15, 16 years of work, and looks like we're about to put something up, so that's very exciting.
And you're about to put something up because you've met a challenge made by Governor Malloy in the state of Connecticut, essentially to match some of your funding. What is the update that you can give us on this? What milestones did you reach?
Well, the milestone we reached, we had to raise $1.4 million. And if we did that, we received $1 million from the state, which is a great challenge. And in 18 months, we accomplished it. And I cannot tell you if you look at our donor list and you see people were giving us $6, $12. I mean, it was remarkable to see organizations, foundations, individuals all coming together to help us out on this. And I think that feat alone is mind-boggling for me, even after all these years. And I've been fundraising for 15 years, so we knew we could do it, but we didn't know how long it would take. And Catherine Smith and Christina and Governor Malloy, Kathy, all had were very encouraging and believed we could do it. And I think it's such a great thing for Connecticut, so everybody should be excited.
Christina, talk a bit about this project and why it was so important for the state of Connecticut.
Well, in 2014, I hadn't obviously been working for the state as yet, but when the governor made this challenge grant, he talked about that this represents a leap of faith and a new way of collaborating with the sector. And I think that Ellen, in 18 months, $1.4 million. So the $1 million that the state is investing in this project is bond dollars, right? So that's capital improvement dollars that will help Ellen transform the mill that will house this monumental work of art. I'm just so impressed with 18 months. What they've done in 18 months is equivalent to many, arts nonprofit organizations' annual budgets, right? I think that this really is, and Ellen, I hate to give you like another job, but you should totally do a roadshow on this because I think what you have done is extremely impressive and inspiring for many creatives across the state who want to figure out how to do this kind of thing. This is hard work, right? Matisse said creativity takes courage. Right, and Ellen really shows that in this project.
Well, and Ellen, one of the things that we were talking about, Christina and I, was this economic imperative of art, and you have had to both be the artist who gets together these kids across America and all of these artists and architects and your own vision for this, but then you've also had to go out and raise money, and that's a difficult thing for a lot of artists. That's something that I'm sure a lot of your colleagues don't maybe have the stomach for, the right temperament for, but that's something you've been doing for, a couple decades now.
Well, I don't have the stomach for it. I'll start by saying that. I hate fundraising. And when it started out, it was one thing for me to have this idea, and basically inspired by our own two kids who were clueless about work going on around them, and I thought it's really important. We've got to do something in this country that reminds every one of us who we are, where we're going, why other people want to live in this country. Why does Christina come here from Jamaica and call Connecticut her home and love it? But there's a lot of things to love. There's a lot of things to improve. But, we got to look at ourselves and go, yes, this is who we are. So it started there. And once it starts and once the ball gets rolling and then you say, you know, if it's a John and Judy I'm interested in this, I want to involve kids across the country. I want to get them all stoked and excited the way I am. So once they get involved, you have 10,000 kids working on this thing, now you're fundraising for them. And this is the difference. I was able to go out and say, this is so important. I promise these kids. I promise kids in Washington and North Carolina, and we've got to get this done. And well, I think it, you know, it's something that resonates with everyone when they realize that it's just not about one crazy artist and her idea. It's about all of us.
And it's also about a very specific place, and it's the town that I call home. And when I talk with Christina Newman-Scott about economic development, talk, Ellen, about what this means for the little town of Winsted, nestled out in the northwest corner. This is one of many, many mill buildings. Some of them have people living in them. Many of them stand vacant, waiting for someone to do something with them. Talk about what you think this could mean for a little tiny town of less than 10,000.
Well, Winsted is perfectly suited for the project. Number one, I didn't want to put this giant mural in a new Butler building. One of the things we're going to accomplish here is we're going to restore an old mill building. And to me, I've been over this with you before when we talked, these buildings are our cathedrals. Every time we lose one of these great mill buildings, we're losing a piece of our history as a country. And we're a young country. We don't have that much history. We need to take care of these buildings. So when we restore this, I think it's an example of another way to use an old mill building, and so people can recognize the beauty of the building. Winsted itself is absolutely, you know, I told everybody last week, was it, Christina, when we made this announcement in this freezing cold building, rain pouring down, Christina was a champ to come and make the announcement. But I said, you know, here we are. There's 30 of us, a motley crew of wet, freezing people who are part of something that has, you know, we've been working for a long time. And Winsted is that group. And if you just expand it to the whole town, over these years, since we bought the buildings in 2006, that's how long we've been working on this, I've come to know so many people in Winsted. I love this town, and they are so ready to see this renewal. And what we can be is we can be an example for a lot of other small towns in Connecticut that, all right, if you want to do something and you want to really get something going in your town, don't sit and whine about it. Get up and raise money and think of a way you can bring people into that town and cause renewal. And this is what's happening in Winsted.
Ellen Grzycic is an artist. She's the president of the American Mural Project. Of course, we have links on our site, wnpr.org/where we live. If you want to find out more about the project, construction to begin this year on this project that's been so long in the making. Ellen, we'll keep getting updates from you, but thank you so much for spending some time with us once again.
Oh, I am so excited, John. I always have so much fun talking to you, and Christine is the best. Connecticut is so lucky to have her. So
thanks,
we're
Ellen.
Really on a roll here.
Ellen Grzycic is on a roll on the phone with us. Thank you so much.
Okay.
But before we move on from this, Christina, one of the things she is doing here is reclaiming these buildings. She talks about these old mill buildings that are not just in my part of the state, but all across the state, in Willimantic and in the Naugatuck Valley, as the cathedrals. They're cathedrals of work. I mean, the people made their livings there and made their lives there for decades and decades and decades. And in many places, they've stood vacant, and some of them are very hard to remediate. There's brownfield concerns. Mm-hmm. There's concerns that, you know, $1 million spent in an old building that leaks air very easily is not as well spent as a brand new construction, but people keep working at these things. What do you think the role of DECD, of your office, is to activate more of these spaces that loom over these small towns but are vacant in so many cases?
Well, I think it's a priority, and Tim Sullivan, who's the deputy commissioner, is deeply invested in this, right? And so he runs the Brownfield program. And through the SHPO office, with our tax credit program, it's a really great opportunity. And we've been talking about how we can do some more kind of strategic work in terms of placing the arts, right, as kind of as a center for reimagining some of these spaces. I mean, think about Miami Basel. If you've been to Miami Basel, you've seen that some of these warehouse spaces that now house these monumental collections from collectors all over the world, right? Now, a colleague of mine, Steve Holmes, you know, he's been toying with this idea that I find very interesting, that, you know, what if we were to work with major collectors that we do have in the state of Connecticut and partner them up, you know, with the DECD through the Brownfields program to rehab a mill site that could house a collection that would be free and accessible to the public, right? But if we kind of looks, let's say it's Winsted. Let's say we pilot this project
in Winsted.
Put everything in Winsted. No, we have to share the love.
We do.
But if, say, it's in Winsted and we look at that opportunity, find a few collectors to partner with us at, and then the ripple effects of that is, say, for instance, Hartford Stage. They have a prop factory. What if we started to extend that idea and create an educational space that then could train young people in the making and design of sets and props and showcase props that are being used in our various performing arts centers across the state? There's so much possibility, and we've definitely started having these conversations. So I'm excited about what the future might hold.
Before I let you go, there's many things to talk about, including some of the challenges that you face in your job. One of them has to do with diversity, about actually making sure that our arts and culture community reflects the actual population of Connecticut. Tell me about what you're working on there.
So, you know, right now, it's a lot of conversation. So since I've been there a little over 10 months, and I've been going across the state of Connecticut, meeting with our arts leaders, meeting with stakeholders, mayors, select men and women, talking about just their cultural fabric, right, of their communities. And as we're having the conversation, I'm kind of pointing them in the direction of studies that have come out recently, such as the Andrew Mellon Foundation did a study on diversity in museums across the nation, where we see that over 60% of museum staff are female. Great. Go, ladies. Of that, 28% or so are of color. But of that 28%, only 4% are people of color in leadership positions. And 2% of those are Asian American, 4% African American. Those numbers are just way too low. So I think it's a good opportunity, and I've been thinking about how we can partner with an academic institution to do similar cultural diversity studies, similar to what New York Department of Cultural Affairs recently did, that shows that the majority of the workforce in the cultural sector in New York is Caucasian. But I don't think anyone is doing this on purpose. We just have to have a productive conversation and create and identify strategies that can make sure that as we move towards 2050, that our cultural spaces are reflective of the people who live in our cities and towns.
I mean, what's your theory without the studies that you hope for? What's your theory on why that is? I mean, does part of it have to do with education? I mean, you say you come from a middle-class household in Kingston, Jamaica, where you had the opportunity, despite what your parents wanted you to do, to go into the arts. But not everyone has that opportunity, and certainly in many minority communities that is the case.
Yes.
Is education a piece of it? What do you think is...
I think education is absolutely a piece of it. I mean, I don't think, no matter what, where you are, what, you know, what your background is, there are you'd probably less than 5% of parents, if not less than that. None of them are saying, hey, you know what I want you to grow up and do? Be an artist. But I'm saying, yes, that is an absolute, that is an amazing choice to make. However, we have to change how we look at our creative jobs and access to these jobs, because we tend to think in a very linear way about what it means to be an artist. And when you say the word artist, one can conjure an easel painter in a park. One might see a ballet dancer. There's just so much more to that.
And a lot of parents see someone who doesn't have a gainful employment. A lot of parents see someone
the
who
starving,
works at Starbucks. And
this is,
and that is one of the problems, the changing what an artist means. I have to take a phone call quickly on this subject, though. Our friend Derek is calling from South Windsor. Hello, Derek.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well, Derek. What's on your mind?
Well, you kind of stole my thunder a little bit, because that's what I wanted, was to ask the Jamaican lady. I'm from Jamaica myself, and I want to know how much this art has impacted the Caribbean community and in what way. And is this going to be something that extended to the Caribbean, not just here in America, but, you know, in internationally? That's really my question, John.
Thank you, Derek.
So, you know, thank you for that question. Well, we know that Jamaica, if you think of just Jamaica, right, what will come to your mind first? If it's not Bob Marley, it's Usain Bolt. Creativity, entertainment, and sports are huge a huge part of the Jamaican economy. We know that in Connecticut, the capital city has the third largest West Indian population in the nation. And a big part of that is, you know, what the a great byproduct of that is the cultural richness that comes with those people. So I think the opportunity here, if we were to do a study, is to identify opportunities for more collaboration and kind of shining a light, a bigger light on some of the communities that I think aren't as visible, right?
Yeah. What do you think is going to be the impact of budget cuts that are coming, not just to the arts in Connecticut, but across the board in Connecticut? I just had the governor on yesterday. He knows times are very tough. I can't imagine that the arts is not going to feel some impact from this. We've heard about 25% funding cuts in some of the departments that you deal with. What can you tell us?
Well, I support the governor's budget. I know that this is the beginning of a process. They're right at the beginning of it. I'll say this. I work with all of the state art agencies across the nation, all of the state art agency executive directors, and there is not one state that's being like, you know what? We are so fine. We're all set. We've got all the money that we need. So I think what I think about is the opportunity that this brings for us to, as we're talking about education, work much more closely with our leaders on the city level, right? Our mayors are on the front lines. And many of them don't understand the importance of integrating kind of creativity and some of their thinking around urban planning, illiteracy, homelessness, blight, health equity. There is a role for the arts in all these areas. And the more that we can empower them and educate them, the more nationally competitive they will become.
You've got Arts Day coming up on March 2nd. And we haven't had Arts Day in a while in the state. What's happening on March 2nd?
So March 2nd, Connecticut Arts Day, is the first day that the Connecticut Office of the Arts, in partnership with our Connecticut Arts Council, our regional arts organizations, we have 9 of them, so they're the arts councils across. And our advisory and tourism council, we have so many wonderful people that help us out. But the office, it's the first time for us in over a decade. And so on that day, it's all about what we're calling moving the arts from nice to necessary. And we'll have speakers like Jay Dick from Americans for the Arts coming out. The lieutenant governor is going to be doing welcome remarks along with Commissioner Catherine Smith. Titus Kafar, a fantastic artist based in New Haven. Are you familiar with Titus?
Yes.
He's fabulous. He's going to be telling his story and participating in conversations.
Very cool.
And then at the end of the day, we close with a keynote by a gentleman, Theo Edmonds, who is the founder of this place called Ideas X Lab in Louisville, Kentucky. And he places arts at the center of corporate and social innovation. And he's been doing some phenomenal work with health around healthcare and using arts as a catalyst for change in the health sector. So he's going to be talking about that work. And I'm pretty excited. We have legislators participating. Senator Duff has been very supportive. Senator Wang. You know, we're all coming together to support the 50 years of investment that this state has made in the arts sector. And by the way, SHPO has been 60 years of preservation.
Christina Newman Scott, Director of Culture for the State of Connecticut. More to talk about, and we'll have you back again soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, we're going to have the latest installment in our housing and homelessness series with WNPR contributor Susan Campbell. That's next Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, Paul Gianfrido is CEO of Mental Health America, but he's got deep roots in Connecticut. He's a former state representative, and he's the former mayor of Middletown, who now advocates for people with mental illness. His book, Losing Tim, explores his own son's struggle with the mental health system and what reforms could be made to prevent similar examples in the future. Hope you can join us for this conversation. It's on Mondays Where We Live. Today in the program, we're going to check back in with Susan Campbell. She's a writer and a columnist for the Hartford Courant. She's been covering housing and homelessness for WNPR over the course of this last year, and she brings us the latest in her series. And first of all, welcome back to the show, Susan.
Hi, John.
And I want to welcome in Bracia Hilliard, who is a Hartford native, a mother of two, who told her story to Susan Campbell, and it's an amazing story. And I'm so glad to see you here.
Hi.
I'm really glad you can make it in. And if you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. We're going to get some news that we talked about around homelessness in Connecticut with the governor yesterday. But Susan, first of all, how did the two of you find each other?
We found each other because a homeless activist named Sarah Ratchford is a friend of mine and is also a friend of Brescia's. You spent time together at Marshall House, correct?
Right.
Okay, so they knew each other. I think Sarah just ran into you accidentally downtown one day.
Yes, downtown at the Bushnell.
There you go. And Brescia was on the brink of losing housing, and Sarah rapidly started emailing and texting and calling people she thought might be able to do something. And in the end, Nate Fox, one of the people she called, was able to do something. I was on the list. All I did was make other phone calls.
Yes.
The story that Susan tells is on our website, WNPR.org, and you can read it through. But, Brescia, talk about when things started to go wrong for you. Susan tells the story in about August of 2015. What happened in your life that made it so difficult?
I recently rented an apartment out on Franklin Avenue, a two-bedroom that was on the third floor. I kept calling. I gave security deposit to the central realtors, and they told me that I needed to wait 2 weeks for the renovation, and then I would move in. And then they took the security deposit, which was $1,100. After the 2 weeks was up, I called. I showed up to the office, and I was like, hey, the first is coming up. What should I do? Should I come move in? Can I grab the keys and whatnot? And she's like, oh, the landlord hasn't renovated. Can you wait a couple more days? So 2 days later, I called again. I'm like, hey, can I get the keys? Can I at least move in? They let me move all my furniture, all my clothes, and all my children's clothes into the apartment, but they would not let us actually move in to live there or actually put gas or lights in the name. So this was on a Monday. That following Tuesday, she called me. She's like, hey, listen, they don't want to renovate the apartment. They don't want to clean out anything. We're just going to give you back $300 of your security deposit, and you have 12 hours to move your things out. The last bit of money that I had was put towards the security deposit. So I had no money, nowhere to go, and just $300 that they gave me. So I knew it wasn't right. So I spent the last of my $300 and stayed at the hotel downtown Hartford. And that lasted me from Tuesday to Friday. So here I was Friday. I had a checkout at 11 a.m. and had nowhere to go. So I went to the little they had a get together that Saturday at the Bushnell. So I'm like, let me find some type of food and somewhere to go for a couple hours till I find at least a shelter to go to. And that's when I ran into Sarah Ratchford.
Mm. And Susan, the story of like losing all the money you have on a security deposit, this is not the first time you've, I'm sure, heard a story like this.
Not at all. There are some people who will take advantage of economically vulnerable people. In Bree's favor now, she has an attorney, Ken Krajewski, who will make this all right. But when you've given your last bit of money and then you've spent money on a motel and you don't have family to rely on or friends you can call and say, hey, can you help me out with the security deposit? She was spiraling very quickly back into the shelter.
And you're not on your own. You have two little kids. Tell me about them.
Yes. I have a 5-year-old named Jaslyn and a 1-year-old actually on March 16th. His name is Ja'Kai.
And what did it mean to you to have these two kids who you needed to take care of and not have a place for them to stay?
I felt lost. I felt like a bad mother. I felt like I had gave up everything that I worked hard for my kids. Words can't explain how I felt. My daughter was asking me, like, Mommy, where are we going to stay at tomorrow? Mommy, why do we have to pack all our stuff in one bag? And it was just hard explaining to a 5-year-old, like, you're not going to have your own room anymore, or you're not going to be able to sleep in your own bed. We all have to sleep in the bed together, and without explaining it without her knowing the truth.
And Susan, family homelessness is a huge problem. It's a much more difficult problem in many ways than people who are on the street by themselves.
Individuals. When you add children to the mix, it becomes crucial to keep people out of homelessness. And the focus of the state in these next few months will be on family homelessness, first chronic homelessness, then family homelessness. And it's a very complicated, complex problem. But the idea is to keep families housed. So the shelter, you want to divert people from going into the shelter. Once a family's in the shelter, they tend to stay, not long necessarily, but all the studies show that children suffer immeasurably from being in shelters, no matter how good or good-hearted shelter workers are. They tend to do worse in school. They tend to have more behavioral problems. They don't have the stability that any child needs.
Adjusting to everyday struggles. They're used to a certain schedule, especially my five-year-old. She's used to coming home to a home-cooked meal, being able to take a bath and getting ready for tomorrow, and she couldn't even do that living in a hotel. Everything was just compact, back to back to back.
It was suggested to you during this time that you call Department of Children and Families, but you didn't do that. Tell me about that decision.
Yes, I actually did call Department of Children and Families. Yeah. I called 211 at first. Sitting at the shelter downtown Hartford, I called 211 because the shelter there, they don't take any children under 1 year old. So when I called 211, they suggested that I call that they, since all the shelters were full, they suggested that I call Department of Children and Families and see what they can do. And when the Department of Children and Families were contacted, they told me to wait at Burger King. And this was at 6 p.m. that night. The DCF worker did not show up till about 10 p.m. And Burger King was closed. We were stuck outside talking to the DCF worker, the investigator.
Exactly. Susan, I'm looking at you. And we've had plenty of conversations with and about the Department of Children and Families, and of course they have this enormous impossible job.
Exactly.
But this enormous impossible job is about taking care of the most vulnerable people in our state, children, and including Bree's children.
It's about the individual cases, and in this case, I think Bree had a very big possibility of falling through the cracks. In the end, DCF came through. They absolutely came through. They were pivotal in getting her house. But that first night, and she was telling me these stories, and I'm thinking, wait a second, you have a how old are your children? And I'm thinking, you know, you say I have a child under the age of one. That flips a switch. Now it's go time. Let's get these people housed. And it wasn't that way for a while.
So tell me about the path to you getting housed. What has happened in the last several weeks and months to get you to a place to live?
The Department of Children and Families did help me. I got hooked up with a worker named Manny. He is a DCF worker. He actually did the paperwork for the Connections, which is a supportive housing. They pay 70% and I pay 30%. The only problem with that is that if you are unemployed, you still have to pay that 30%. So that's a struggle that I'm having right now, is actually to be able to find a job. So,
and you're trained as an LPN,
right?
As a nurse, but that's not what you're working in right now. Tell me about your path to find work that's meaningful to you and is able to help you support your family.
As of right now, I'm pretty much open. I'm trying to find a dispatcher, call center, office work job, anything that's fast and willing to have me support my family. As of right now,
that issue, and Susan and I have talked about some of these stories in the past, and I think people don't understand the difficulty of finding a place to live while trying to find a place to work, while trying to raise kids. Can you talk about that, about the stress, maybe the pressure that you feel under to do all of these things simultaneously that are also incredibly important?
Everything happened so fast with me and my situation. I lost just about everything. I had to quit my job. I had to find a place to stay. And every time I would find a step, like, for example, they gave me the apartment, the studio apartment at first on Weathersfield Avenue. I was staying there from September till just recently, and I had the apartment and they were paying the rent and everything, but it was hard for me to get a job because of childcare. And with my son, because he's under one, a lot of the childcare was full, or a lot of the childcare was too far for my transportation. So every time you get a step up with either the transportation, the housing, or the job, you get two steps back because you have to think of where are my children going to go while I go to work, or how am I going to be able to pick up my daughter if I have to get out of work at 5 o'clock and her bus comes at 5:03. So it's just being able to find a job and having the kids be able to have childcare afterwards.
So what's missing here, Susan? I mean, just because we hear all these various things that are happening, what's missing in the, as we call it, the safety net or whatever it is that the state and the city is supposed to provide to people so that these terrible situations don't happen? What do you see as the things that are missing?
I think there are still silos, even though the people who are seeking to end homelessness as we know it have done magnificently. There are still silos in thinking that there's not an understanding that being economically vulnerable, being poor, is a full-time job. Mm-hmm. You've got You've got appointments that you have to keep. You probably don't own a car. You're relying on bus schedules, and you're trying to fit all these big pieces into a puzzle, and it doesn't fit. So right now, Brescia desperately needs a job. She's qualified for far more than what she's doing right now. It's finding the time to apply for those jobs, getting childcare that fits in there, and there's no one place to call to say, okay, help me. Here are my situation. 211 does a great job, but here's my situation.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, now yesterday in our program, Governor Malloy was here, and he was making an announcement that Connecticut is the second state in the nation to end veterans homelessness. We have talked in the past about how the state had ended chronic homelessness amongst veterans, and this is all part of a plan that we've discussed, Susan, that is meant to end chronic homelessness in the state by the end of this year. When you hear the governor's announcement yesterday, first of all, quickly, what's your response? I mean, are we essentially ending veterans homelessness?
Would that it were so. That's the boiled down version, is that we've ended veterans homelessness among veterans. What we have actually done is reached what's called functional zero. And I hate it when I call someone and I just want a number, and Brian Rocapriori at CCEH, I'm talking to you. I just want to know, is this how I can say this? In fact, more accurately, if you say Connecticut takes 3.2 months to house a veteran who's homeless, then they need to get to three veterans in the state to say, we have now reached functional zero. So we can say that the Department of Housing and Urban Development has vetted it, checked off, that Connecticut is the first state to reach functional zero in homelessness among veterans. Now they're turning their eyes to chronic homelessness, which is much more pernicious and much more expensive.
As we run low on time, Brescia, I asked Susan about this, about the things that maybe are missing. What are the things that were missing for you, and what were the things that were really godsends for you, the things that helped you along the way?
The things that helped me along the way were my support system, Susan Campbell, Sarah Ratchford, Nate Fox. They were all there for me when I didn't have anything. I think that what the state is missing is to be able to, like, kind of like a comfortability. Like, if a family is homeless and they need help and they go to a shelter, the people that are working at the shelter should make them feel comfortable, make them feel like, hey, I know your situation. Let me help you with your situation. Let me help you find a job. If you need daycare, help with the daycare. Part of the reason of the homelessness with the parent is they're alone. They have no one to talk to. They have no one to help get that extra step up that they need. If they need childcare, help them find childcare. If you're at a shelter, you need a job, you need to help with the interview, help them get the clothes that they need to wear for the interview, help them prepare for the interview, help them for transportation, have some type of, you know.
But that word you use, it, comfortable, and that's so important, because I think we take that for granted, right? Like, we think, well, life on the street is hard, and so it's going to be hard to get people into a shelter and hard. And what you're talking about as a mother of two young children is you needed a soft space where someone was warm and comforting, and that's important.
Right. Not too much of a parent figure to me, like someone just to be like, it's okay, we got this, just hold on, like, you know, some type of uplifting something, like, I don't even know how to explain it. It's just like, just tell me, just, you got this. That's all I needed to hear sometimes.
Well, I have to say, reading your story and learning about what you've been through and also what has happened now in your life, I hope it does inspire other people, and I'm sure that that's one of the reasons you want to tell this story, right?
Right.
You know, to actually make sure other people know that other people are out there willing to help. Brescia Hilliard is a Hartford native. She's a mother of two, and she's the feature in this story that Susan Campbell did for us. First of all, Brescia, thank you so much for spending time with us.
I really
appreciate it. It's great to meet you. And Susan, thank you once again for your great series. You got more stories like this coming up soon.
Absolutely. I'm actually going to be looking at veterans and homelessness and the cost savings that Connecticut's seeing now.
And you can find more about these stories at WNPR.org/where we live. Thanks again, Susan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our program, as always, is produced by Lydia Brown with Tucker Ives. Kyan Wolf is our technical producer. The digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. Ben Esty and Alex Ingber are our interns. Continue this conversation at WNPR.org/where we live. I'm John Dankosky. Please have a great weekend.